From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is InSight. I'm Beth Ruyak. What a balancing act California and the rest of the country finds itself in. How long, in the interest of safety from the coronavirus, should we stay at home? Or if you flip the question, how soon and in what ways should public life be reopened? At the state capitol in Sacramento yesterday, a few hundred people were permitted to protest, and CAP Radio reporter Sarah Mises-Tan was there. Here's some of what was said in her conversation with protesters.
Doreen Denley of Chico says she hasn't seen the virus affect her community.
I work in the emergency room, an empty emergency room right now, and this is a scam. This is a way to take our freedoms back one at a time.
Tom Orr was also protesting on the lawn. He owns a construction company in Rancho Cordova and says he had to lay off over half of his workers because of how much business he's lost.
We need to stop this craziness and let people get back to work before the economy completely tanks. The numbers don't justify the shutdown. I mean, do you know anybody who's died from the coronavirus?
Jill Young, another protester who was visiting from Galt, says she's also seen economic loss.
In my little town, there's a lot of businesses that are closed right now. It's sad.
Similar protests dotted the country. Some people in Sacramento questioned why the California Highway Patrol had approved the permit for a protest of 500 people. A spokesperson for the CHP told CAP Radio the permit was issued, quote, with the understanding that a crowd would abide by social distancing orders. Because that didn't happen, the CHP says it will evaluate future permits on a case-by-case basis. California's governor, meanwhile, at the same time as the protest was happening downtown, was holding firm in his statement in his daily press conference to the stay-at-home orders. He said that there are specific measures for any reopening.
Science, health, will be the determination. But the reason last week we socialized, made public this roadmap to recovery is to let folks know we are deeply focused on what that reopening looks like. We just want to do it in a very deliberative and thoughtful way to keep those protesters safe and to keep their families and a broader community of California safe.
Meanwhile, state lawmakers are reviewing the governor's spending on the COVID-19 battle. CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd has been tracking this. He is with me in the studio, safely distanced. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Beth. Glad to have you back.
So the California Assembly met yesterday. The state Senate met last week. Talk to me about these reviews.
So it was the first time that legislators convened since they adjourned back in March. And the Senate last week, there's an interesting difference between the two houses, where the Senate is allowing remote legislating. So you saw just a couple people in the chambers, and a number of other people were basically piped in through a video conference. On the Assembly side, they did not allow remote legislating. So pretty much all the members of the committee were there in person. So that was an interesting slight difference. But many of the witnesses who were part of these hearings, they were remote. And those were people that were in the administration, in Newsom's administration, who have been handling the response to coronavirus. And what lawmakers wanted to learn about was, you know, what does this response look like? You know, what are the nuts and bolts beyond what has been expressed to the public so far? You know, how has this come together and what is it going to look like moving ahead into the future? They really wanted to start exercising that oversight role.
The governor has praised multiple times publicly lawmakers for going ahead and essentially giving the green light to the spending. Did it initially come with some oversight, some sort of checks and balance built into it?
Exactly. So lawmakers did grant Newsom a lot of latitude when they, right before they adjourned in March, they said, hey, we know we're looking at a potential crisis here, and we're going to hand you a lot of, you know, responsibility and a lot of freedom to roam. So they gave him up to $1 billion of spending, initial spending for the response to coronavirus. It was $500 million at first, and then it would be increased in increments along the way. And lawmakers would have to basically sign off on those increases. And so far, they've signed off on all of them. It's just a matter of making sure that they've been able to have visibility over it. but it hasn't necessarily been up to what many lawmakers were expecting or hoping in terms of the transparency. And here's Assemblymember Phil Ting. He's the vice chair of the Joint Legislative Budget Committee. And here's what he had to say about Newsom's leadership so far.
We obviously gave the governor a significant amount of discretion because we were dealing with an emergency. The administration has done an admirable job to help get the state through this. But having said that, we had hoped that there would be more transparency before the expenditure and definitely more transparency after the expenditure. They really owe it to the entire state to give public and transparent answers.
Think about what was happening at the time that this decision was being made. We were all talking about flattening the curve because the spike in what was coming, the surge, the attack rate, the governor would say, was so powerful and so frightening that to say, if you need $1 billion, yes, we'll give it to you. The fact that they're now coming back and saying, let's look at how it was spent, says something about where we are in this process.
I would say so, yeah. I mean, I spoke to folks in leadership on the Assembly side and on the Senate side, and both of them said, you know, on both sides, they said, you know, we're not here to in any way, you know, point fingers or say that. They basically said, we're not here to criticize, you know, basically any decision making so far. We just want to make sure that we have more oversight. But I don't think it's coincidental that these hearings came after a very big expenditure by the state. It was a $1 billion contract that's gotten a lot of attention that the Newsom administration entered into for masks, for protective masks. And it was, again, $1 billion for 200 million masks per month over the course of a couple months. And that deal was in a lot of ways met with a lot of praise because the state desperately needs these masks. Frontline healthcare workers and first responders are reusing a lot of these masks, so they desperately need it. But lawmakers, from what I can tell, looked at it and said, okay, let's take a look at what's under the hood of this deal and see sort of what the nuts and bolts are.
That contract, though, hasn't been made transparent, hasn't been opened up to the public, and I'm not sure lawmakers have seen it either, have they?
Lawmakers have not seen it, and that was a point of, I would say, contention during the hearings, both in the Senate and in the Assembly. Senator Richard Pan, he asked folks over at the Office of Emergency Services, you know, when are we going to see this contract? We think you owe it to us and to the public to show, you know, what was in this deal. And the Office of Emergency Services said, you know, we intend to make this public. And they've said that all along, that they intend to make it public, but they haven't put a specific timeline on it. And they've said, we want assurances that these products will be delivered before we release it. They're afraid that it could compromise this deal. And Senator Richard Pan said, well, please consider releasing it to lawmakers because we need to exercise our oversight function. It was a pretty remarkable exchange.
It's an overseas contract. It's an out-of-the-country contract, which adds to some of the, for lack of any other word, intrigue to begin with.
Yeah, it's with a Chinese multinational called BYD. It's actually, I believe, a subsidiary of that company. That does add to it, I think. Partly it's the overseas transaction, but it's also a matter of the scramble that's happening. I mean, California is competing with other states, with the federal government, with other countries to try to find this protective equipment. And so, you know, there's a lot of intrigue built into this. And a lot of it is basically they want to make sure that while the end result is good, the means of getting there, everything checks out. And also that the quality of the products that California is getting and that the frontline workers will be using, that it's up to snuff.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with CAP Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd. Let's get back to the money. We already said $1 billion was initially allocated, but there was room for more spending.
There was. So, you know, if you look at how it was broken down, Governor Newsom was able to pull some existing emergency response funding in as well to basically play with. So he essentially had, off the top of my head, I believe it was about $2.3 billion $1 billion. And so, you know, that about 1.3 was spent largely on protective equipment, protective gear, and he spent about 700 million of that 1 billion that was allocated to him. So, you know, he hasn't been shy about spending money. And for the most part, lawmakers have concurred with what the spending has been on. There was a little dissent yesterday with some folks on the Republican side. Assemblymember Jay Obernolte said, you know, look, we understand that this is a crisis situation. We appreciate the effort of the Newsom administration, but one issue area they identified was spending on social services and the social safety net. And Jay Obernolte said, you know, we're not sure that this is the appropriate time to be spending, or maybe this isn't the appropriate way to be going about spending on social services. So there has been some friction there, but there's also been friction about how the administration has communicated with local entities. And here's what Assemblymember Obernolte said.
Now, we understand that there's been a huge state effort expended in spinning up these programs for the procurement of PPE, creating a distribution warehouse and a system for getting those out to the organizations and communities that need them. And we're, I think, united in our desire to see that be as efficient and expeditious as possible. I think everyone on this dais has heard stories from our local communities about hospitals and counties and cities that submitted requests for PPE to the state and then just didn't hear back. So I'll tell you some stories from my own district. I've had hospitals that submitted requests that they never heard word one, and then a couple weeks later, 10% of their order showed up. I've had other times when nothing ever showed up and nothing was said. And so my question is this. I mean, understanding that this is a crisis, there's a huge need, but can't we be a little bit better at providing good customer service to these organizations that need this equipment? At the very least, I think we should be responding to every request, even if it's to say, we got your request, we're processing it, we're short on personnel, or we can't fill it right now, we're sorry, you know, we think we're going to be able to at this, you know, certain date in the future, or, you know, we can't fill it all, but we're going to be giving you 10%. I mean, it seems to me like we should be doing a better job at conveying that information, and I'd like to know if we're making efforts in that respect.
And I've heard that from other local entities as well, such as public health departments, who have said, you know, we understand Newsom and his administration is working as hard as possible. However, communication has been lacking in terms of what's coming up around the curve. But I think it's also important to note that in a lot of ways, there's this interesting duality where I've heard complaints or concerns about lack of communication, but also, you know, to Newsom's credit, he has been delivering noon press conferences almost every single day, going into granular detail in a lot of ways of what the state is doing, what he is doing in terms of his response, and taking a lot of questions from reporters, and often answering them directly with specificity right off the top of his head, mm-hmm. which has been pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. So there is this duality. I've heard communication breakdowns, but it's also important to give credit to Newsom that he has been out there and communicating with the public almost every day.
So looking ahead, the governor has said that the initial response in terms of spending to the COVID-19 battle might be, first there was this $5 million, then $6 million. Now it's up to as much as $7 billion. Excuse me, not million, billion, up to $7 billion. So you think about the budget process that's ahead and what this might mean and where the cuts to accommodate will be.
Well, I mean, Newsom has made something clear basically to the public and to lawmakers. I mean, he said, take that January budget that he proposed and set it aside. You know, it's going to look a lot different once he comes back with a revised budget in May. And, you know, that $222 billion budget from January had a lot of ambitious spending in it. And quite frankly, there's just not going to be that opportunity for spending for, you know, big ambitious programs. It's going to look like a much more scaled back version of a budget that preserves essential services, tries to not slash spending on existing programs, and of course, focuses a lot of energy and attention on the current coronavirus response, but also making sure that there's preparation looking ahead. I mean, I'm not a fan of the phrase, you know, don't waste a crisis, but It's clear that public health advocates are saying, look, this is exactly what happens when you don't invest in public health. And so you're probably going to see increased spending for public health.
Meanwhile, the state does have reserves and has been enjoying a decade of growth.
Yeah. And those reserves, there's been a lot of reporting and a lot of discussion that those reserves will pretty much be emptied. Obviously, it's great to have those reserves and it's going to be a cushion for the blow of what's coming in terms of a recession. But I spoke to my colleague, Nicole Nixon, and I spoke to Speaker Anthony Rendon in recent days. And he addressed that issue of having that, enjoying those 10 years of growth and how the coming years are probably going to look quite a bit different.
Look, I got elected in 2012, and my class has lived a very charmed life here in Sacramento. We got here after the recession. I think we're going to have to learn to live within a different set of means. And I think any bill that's going to have a significant price tag is something that definitely needs to be looked at differently. We don't have a sense of what our revenues are going to be yet. We certainly don't have a sense of what our costs are going to be yet as a state. So I think any bill with a big financial price tag is something we're going to have to take a much closer look at.
And so I read that as, you know, this is a billboard to lawmakers in his house saying, you know, pet projects, things that go beyond what is essential, and certainly bills that have a big expense attached to them, you know, that's going to have a tough time getting through this year and possibly into years to come.
Well, on the subject of reopening bit by bit, the legislature has a plan to reconvene in the not too distant future.
Yeah, May 4th. They were originally planning to reconvene in April. They pushed it back to May 4th, and I have heard no word that they plan to push it back further. You know, I would guess that this first set of committee hearings was kind of a trial run, and it went fairly smoothly. And so it looks like they're going to be reconvening in May. You know, I've heard some chatter about lawmakers trying to figure out how to safely bounce between their district and Sacramento. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now there's a shelter in place order. And so, you know, they're essential workers, so they're not worried about violating the order, but they are worried about, you know, their health and the health of those around them when they're traveling around. So I think there are a lot of logistical questions where, you know, it's already tough for lawmakers to bounce between Sacramento and, say, a faraway district. Now there's only an added complication to that.
Not to mention how close they sit in their desks in the chamber and the face coverings, because it didn't sound like anybody was speaking behind a mask.
There actually were a number of people who were. Some were not wearing masks. Others were. They did all have these sort of protective, I don't know how to describe them, little shower caps on the microphones in the hearings. That's what they looked like. So there were measures taken. I'll be very curious to see what other steps are taken, because absolutely, some of those hearing rooms, some of those, and certainly the chambers, are pretty tight quarters. So we'll see what they end up doing.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Take care.
Thank you.
Scott Rodd is Cap Radio state government reporter, and Governor Newsom will hold another press briefing today. You can hear it live at noon on Cap Radio. Up next, Nevada County. Maybe there is some indication of the season ahead by what's happening in Nevada County. I'll talk with the Health and Human Services director there next. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Some California counties, with their beautiful open landscape, naturally invite people into the outdoors. So what do you do about the stay-home orders and then the need to guard public safety? Ryan Groover's on the phone from Nevada County, where the popular Yuba River winds through the foothills. It draws people to Nevada City, to Grass Valley, and the many, many surrounding open square miles of nature. Mr. Groover is the county's Health and Human Services Director, and Ryan, glad to have you on Insight today. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Beth. Thank you so much for having me today.
Are you ready for people to start venturing out to your area, or is that already happening?
So So that's definitely an area of concern for us. Nevada County has 38 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and unfortunately one death. And for perspective, we have approximately 100,000 people in our county. And in late March to early April, we were experiencing the exponential growth that is so typical of this virus. And then exactly 2 weeks after the governor's stay-at-home order, we started to see a tapering off. We consider this to be somewhat of a dangerous time when you see the improvement in the weather and the tapering off of cases. It's very easy to transition from that initial fear to a place of complacency. And so we are worried, given that we're a magnet for outdoor recreation, that with the improvement, the allure of the river and the mountains will become more difficult to resist. And that outdoor activity, even though you're outdoors and you're theoretically spaced apart, the congregation in parking lots, restroom facilities, and things like that remain a deep concern. And we don't want to get to a situation, given the dormancy of this virus, where it takes a week, 2 weeks before we know we're back in the midst of an outbreak. So we're trying to be very methodical and data-informed in terms of how we think about starting to open things up and the guidance and supports we can provide to allow people to live their lives and enjoy this beautiful community.
You have a new data project. I'll get to that in a second. But I do want to ask about the fact that there is sort of a geography here perhaps at play. The eastern side of the city is full of second homes, vacation homes, cabins. It's a very popular area to go. Have you seen any difference in cases and where cases are trending from a geography standpoint?
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up. You mentioned the Yuba River at the outset. I'd also like to give a shout-out to the outdoor offerings that are in Eastern County, which encompasses the town of Truckee. It's really a region. The community doesn't necessarily stop at the borders, and so we have a regional approach there. And definitely, because of the factors that you've mentioned, short-term rentals, second homes, people coming into the community to recreate, we have seen a heightened level of cases in the Eastern County. In fact, 26 out of our 38 cases were there. That's 68%, despite the fact that the Eastern County only represents 18% of our population. So we've been very active in working with the town. The town of Truckee has been very proactive, as has their hospital, Tahoe Forest Hospital, and we've been working with the neighboring jurisdictions, Placer, El Dorado, and Washoe counties, on a regional approach to supporting the needs of the community up there and trying to make sure that we're not encouraging spread by having people coming and using second short-term rentals and things of that nature.
Tell me more about what you think is happening there and why these numbers are so different.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of travel through that region. The I-80 corridor goes right through there. And then there was definitely, I will say that the leveling of cases includes Eastern County. We saw no cases between April 7th and then until a few days ago. We started seeing just a handful of more cases. So the main growth in the beginning of the outbreak was definitely in the Eastern County, and it has tapered there as well. So I want to point that out. But initially, large areas of concern were, first reports of widespread COVID-19 transmission in California really was focused around Bay Area, and there were reports of people with second homes trying to escape the situation in the Bay Area and come up to the mountains, and that was a false sense of security coming up here. It's something that we've been trying to get out there is that, look, per capita, the level of hospital beds available in a rural community with a 29-bed hospital compared to being in San Francisco or San Mateo, there's a lot less healthcare infrastructure to deal with an outbreak. And the level of transmission that we saw far outpaced the per capita transmission in the state, and we're very thankful that that has started to taper off.
So what's critical to you as you decide what reopening might look like, even opening up campgrounds or recreational outdoor areas?
Yeah, so we're trying to be methodical and data-informed. The governor listed six criteria for reopening, and we're forming a task force that includes local decision-makers, which will include those that from like the Forest Service and State Parks and the Nevada Irrigation District that offer a lot of recreational facilities, also with representation from our cities and town. We're going to try to take a reasonable approach that allows people to live their lives while still having safeguards. If I can be, if we can use an analogy for a moment, if you're a swim coach and you tell your swimmers that, to hold their breath for 10 minutes, they're either going to drown or they're going to disobey. So we can't be so rigid in our interpretation that our citizens face a choice between disobeying or drowning. We have to make sure that we're allowing people to live their lives in a way that that makes the healthy choice the right choice, if that makes sense.
Number one on the governor's roadmap then is testing and the ability to test. So talk to me about what's happening in the county, and maybe this goes hand in hand with the community data project and understanding what the infections are doing in people in the county.
Sure. So testing in Nevada County, there is testing in Nevada County. We've conducted around 900 tests in the county, not we as in public health, but in the community there have been around 900 tests, which is just above the state average, but it's still far from adequate to meet the governor's first criteria for reopening, which is really that ability to aggressively test and contact trace. But testing has gradually started to open up a bit. Our hospitals have started to develop some testing capacity. One of our hospitals has one of these Abbott machines that does quick turnaround, but there's still not enough testing to really ensure that that we can get back to what's called a containment phase of the outbreak. If we don't have community transmission, but we have adequate testing, then we can start to lift some of the restrictions and then aggressively respond to cases as they come up with contact tracing and isolation and quarantine and that kind of a strategy that's more typical of the beginning of an outbreak. And that's where we're trying to return. And so the testing capacity is something that's really an issue at the state and federal levels as well. But what we are trying to do is control the things that are within our power, like making sure that our public health department has adequate capacity to do that contact tracing and investigation. So we're highly focused on that right now.
You sound very aggressive. I do want to know about the data project, and it is, if this is the same one that I'm familiar with, the Connecting Point, a Google Doc-based project, and sometimes there have been issues of concern raised about what people are asked to put into this document, and tell me how you plan to lay it out and what your thoughts are about privacy with it.
So the idea behind this data project, it's a community surveillance project. Surveillance, in this sense, refers to looking out for symptomology associated with COVID-19, and in the absence of testing, allowing people to go out and fill out kind of what their symptoms are so that we can track at a broader level than testing would allow the level of symptoms that are in the community. Part of the issues with testing are that they've been pretty narrowly available previously to people with the more severe symptoms. And so that means that there's a lot of unrecognized COVID-19 potentially in the community. This study recently out of Stanford University showed that the level of COVID-19 antibodies in Santa Clara County was vastly larger than the percentage of the number of people
right.
who had actually tested positive. And
yep.
So this is a tool that's been used in some other jurisdictions for people to enter their symptoms and public health to get some kind of county-level data in terms of how widespread it might be beyond what's showing up through the testing. And so it is something that we're vetting through our HIPAA compliance officer and making sure that this isn't putting people's private health information out there. So, I mean, that's a top concern for our agency in normal times, and it remains a top concern for us now to make sure that that's not data that is personally identifiable or accessible to anybody that shouldn't have it.
Okay, but the symptom tracker, as you're calling it, is now up and available, correct?
Correct, Connecting Point.
Okay, and tomorrow you have a community relief fund that officially goes live. Will you explain that?
Sure. So we're very cognizant of the fact that this public health response to this pandemic has created a lot of hardships throughout the community for local businesses, for nonprofits that are now struggling to keep their doors open. And so the county has provided seed funding to try to spur philanthropic donations so that we can raise money to support struggling local businesses and individuals and nonprofits. And so our Caleb Dardick in our CEO's office is working with organizations on both sides of the county to to try to raise as much money as possible to inject some much-needed relief into our community. So we're very excited about that effort. And more information on that and everything else we've been talking about is available on our website at mynevadacounty.com/coronavirus.
Okay, I just quickly want you to tell me if there are any big gaps. For some areas, it's distance learning tools. Sometimes it's food and food bank needs or outreach to at-risk groups. Where are you seeing these kind of potholes in what you're able to take care of right now?
So, I would say that we've been very proactive in terms of supporting our homeless community, skilled nursing facilities. Our schools have been doing a great job. So really it's that governor's first condition that is highest on my radar in terms of having that testing capacity and that contact tracing capacity to be able to return to some form of normalcy and have a strategy in place to contain. So I think we've done a good job supporting the nutrition needs and those other kind of vulnerable groups that you listed. It's really those conditions for returning to normalcy that I see as the big struggle coming up, and people returning to complacency if they see the cases aren't growing, since it could so quickly reverse and go the other direction.
Okay, one more question. Let's look down the road in May to Memorial Weekend. What do you imagine Memorial Weekend looking like in the Nevada City, Grass Valley, Nevada County area?
And Truckee, yeah, it definitely has to look different. We need to ensure that there's social distancing, that the facilities that encourage people to congregate are either not in operation or are operating differently. And so that's definitely part of what our task forces are going to be looking at in terms of developing that guidance and make sure that there are ways for people to do what they have to do, which is get outside and be physical and make sure that they're maintaining their physical well-being and emotional well-being in a way that's not going to escalate the public health crisis. And so it's going to, hopefully we'll have something in place where people can enjoy the weekend, but in a way that's safe.
And thank you for the reminders about Truckee, such a beautiful little town and area and part, obviously, of Nevada County as well. All right, so for now, the stay-at-home orders are firmly in place. Is that a yes?
That is a yes.
All right, thanks so much for joining us and giving us an update on the county.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Ryan Groover. He is Nevada County's Health and Human Services Director. Now to the North State region of the state, where the coronavirus pandemic comes on the heels of the Camp Fire disaster of 2018. Many people are still in recovery from the experience of that wildfire and previous wildfires. And now there are challenges to providing health care on top of that. Take a listen to Elizabeth Gunderson. She's president of MedSpire Health. And this is from a conversation she had with Christian Solis from North State Public Radio.
There is obviously sort of the kind of the limited resources that were in place even before this pandemic, that there really just aren't that many clinics. And then there's the fact that there's a high percentage of low income that of folks that live on the ridge. But I think that the biggest barrier right now is just fear. What I'm seeing from the phone calls that we're receiving is that patients who have medical concerns and are, actually sick and should see a provider are instead of doing that, are staying home just because they're afraid to interact with the healthcare system. They're afraid of being exposed to the virus. They're afraid of sitting in a doctor's office with other sick patients, knowing that they themselves are medically fragile. And so that's in and of itself a really big problem, because the longer that patients wait at home when they're sick, the sicker that they're going to be when they actually are seen by a provider face to face.
And this is something that's happening everywhere. Elizabeth Gunderson is on the phone with us from San Francisco. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me. Good morning.
You made such a compelling point in that piece of the interview. People might be afraid to deal with health problems. Would you address that in more detail? Give me some examples of the calls you're getting.
Yeah, absolutely. Patients who have conditions that could potentially get worse, like urinary tract infections, high blood pressure, poorly controlled diabetes that, would in a normal context be following up with their primary care providers or seeking medical care, are not doing that. And so I think what we have to do as a medical community is bring healthcare home to our patients as much as we can. And I think that, you know, that looks like telehealth, that looks like phone calls, like video visits, just more aggressively following up with patients in their own homes, so that, you know, we bring them in when they need to come in, but we're being proactive about monitoring their health from afar, since they're not coming to clinics and they're not coming to the hospital.
If there's some sort of circumstance going on that requires a prescription, but it's a telemedicine visit and nobody's seeing each other in person, can a prescription still be written? Is the same sort of care able to be carried out by phone or by video conference?
I would say I didn't have a lot of experience with telemedicine prior to this pandemic, and I've really been surprised how much medicine you can conduct over the phone and over video. There's a lot you can glean just from doing a really good review of systems and getting a really good history from patients. And so the answer is yes, that we most prescriptions can just be called in. And then, again, I think the important part of that is then follow-up. So if you call in a new blood pressure medication for a patient, make sure they have a blood pressure cuff at home, and then schedule a series of follow-up phone calls to track their blood pressure, so you make sure the medication is efficacious. The same thing if you prescribe an antibiotic, for example, for a urinary tract infection. I think the follow-up is a really important piece.
So do you have locations throughout the North State area from San Francisco eastward? Are there standing clinics or trailers?
We serve just the communities in Butte County that were impacted by the fire. So we don't have anything in San Francisco or Sacramento. And we don't have permanent physical locations. We're mobile clinics. So we set up shop kind of the day of our scheduled clinic days. We've been using church parking lots. We use an old firehouse. We've used local businesses in the community. So we kind of just go wherever we can find physical space, and we basically carry our home around on our back. Kind of we carry our setup in trucks and just set up the same day. And that allows us to keep our costs extremely low, so we can help more patients.
Have people come with some of those symptoms that might be COVID-19, might not be? Fever, the cough, shortness of breath, and then what happens?
So we actually are holding, we're doing all of our medicine right now is via telehealth. And that was a decision we made because we bring volunteers from all over the North State, and our patient population is so medically fragile, elderly, vulnerable. And so also because of the shortages of PPE, we made the decision to do home visits for patients when needed, if they need a face-to-face appointment, and then to do telehealth. So for the patients who present with symptoms that look like COVID or make us suspect they could be positive, we're doing phone monitoring of their symptoms and being preemptive if they need to go in face-to-face. But a lot of patients can just quarantine at home and do kind of symptom management. They don't actually need to go into to a doctor's office or to the hospital. They're not sick enough to need that.
For someone listening who might not have been aware of your services, although you've been present in the community all through last year since Campfire Recovery, how do people get in touch with you? What are the insurance requirements or previous visit requirements?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for asking that. So we are we're available by telephone 24/7. We do have an answering machine set up that patients can leave messages on, and we return phone calls within a couple of hours. So they can call us anytime. They can reach out on, and that telephone service is also HIPAA protected. So any information they leave is secure. They can reach out to us via social media. They can email us. We have posters all over the community with our information. So really, we just want to let patients know that we're here for them all the time. We don't take insurance. We don't take payment. We are completely 100% free. We don't ask to see identification. We just want to serve patients, and so we don't need any documentation. And let's see, did I address everything?
You did, and we'll post a link. But would you mind giving the phone number for someone who might be ready to write it down?
Oh yeah, sorry. Hold on one second. Actually, don't have it memorized, although I should. Let's see. It is 1-833-MEDSPIRE.
M-E-D S-P-I-R-E.
Yeah, let's see. So it is.
It's okay. I'd rather you have it be correct, Elizabeth.
Thank you. So 833-633-7747. You can also email us at info@medspire.org.
Okay, again, that's 833-633-7747.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you so much for your time. I think it's so important to speak directly to the parts of all of this that we're afraid of, whatever it might be, and figure out what the pathway is through it, because that helps us get to the other side. And I appreciate the conversation today.
Thank you for having me. Thank
you. You take care and stay safe. Elizabeth Gunderson is president of MedSpire Health. Again, that number 833-633-7747 if you are anywhere in the Butte County area. And we'll post a link at capradio.org/insight. Our uplift is coming up next. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.